do you want to answer one at a time, or?
Well, let me just make that.
We'll answer each one in turn, right? We've got a little bit of time.
Well, let me just refer to it. Look, let me say to start with, I don't want to, you see, necessarily when you're talking about two different ideas and you associate with one rather than the other, it seems to be a kind of a combative approach to it. You're saying this is right, that is wrong. I don't wish to do that in the sense, so I think that when it comes to it, of course, you say I don't attack the basic anarchist principles. I don't attack many of the basic anarchist principles because I happen to share them as principles. In other words, if you say to me you want a society without a government, well, I don't care whether you're an anarchist or a socialist or what label you take at that particular point. In that particular sense, you want a society without a government, you want a society without laws and police and all the rest of it. I share that view, of course. And indeed, you know, one would be very narrow-minded to say that somebody who wants that kind of thing is in the same position as somebody who clearly is opposed to it, somebody who's in the Leninist, vanguardist party, the Tory party, the Labour party, Liberal, SDP party, and the rest of it, who say, we've got to have governments, we've got to have police, we've got to have laws, however they want to organise them, is clearly in a different position to the one that you're in. But what I have done, and also I take your point about 19th century philosophers, clearly, if you don't associate yourself with 19th century philosophers, then of course means that you don't have anything at all to do with the things that they said. You only have to say, I disagree, I don't stand for what Proudhon said, and I say whatever I say about Proudhon can go over your head. It's not an attack upon you. Of course, people like myself who say I am a Marxist, I therefore have to accept that if somebody comes along and says, well, Marx said this, that, or the other, I've got to talk about it. I put myself in that position. But if you don't wish to, that's all right. When you say, however, that I haven't attacked the basic ideas of anarchism, I would argue that I did. I think that in the time that I spoke, I hope you wouldn't see what I said as purely a list of Proudhon said this and he was wrong and Bakunin said that, or taking quotes. I don't think any of the quotations I took were in any way out of context or chosen. As you said yourself, one could easily take quotations from Proudhon, which would make him look like a very unpleasant sort of person. But that's not my purpose. What I did do was I made three basic criticisms of anarchism. One was that I don't think anarchists understand capitalism as a system. And I think it's fundamental that if you want to get rid of the system, you have to do it. It's not an academic exercise. I'm not saying, in other words, you know, that you sit around and hold economics classes about the laws of value for forever and a day. I'm simply saying that the nature of exploitation has to be understood if you want a non-exploitative society. And what I said is that I think that there is a tendency amongst anarchists for that criticism not to take place. Secondly, in relation to the state, I said that I think that anarchists have failed to understand the problem of the state. And I think if you go into the 20th century anarchist movement, the direct action and the anarcho-syndicalists, I think have had serious errors of political judgment about what the state is all about. I mean, when you talk about the anarcho-syndicalists at the turn of the century, and I can tell you now, because this party was around at that time, that was one of the unusual things that has been going for a very long time. And this party at the turn of the century actually produced what I consider to be some of the best articles it's ever published, dealing with this anarcho-syndicalist movement and pointing out, I think in terms which were correct, why it is that through the syndicalist movement, through the ideas of syndicalism, whether they were, you know, Daniel De Leon or French syndicalists or any of the other people, and I'm referring to names because obviously the easiest way to associate an idea is by somebody who wrote about it or said something about it. It pointed out why they were, in the end, erroneous, why they couldn't succeed. And I think there's been a lot of evidence to show that they didn't succeed. But another point, and a third point I made, was in relation to revolutionary change. I was arguing that you've got to do something in relation to getting control of the state. You've got to do something in relation to taking away power from the minority and putting it in the hands of the majority. Now, you are quite right to be cautious about that idea. Because, you know, anything which involves any sort of... It's tempting to say any dealings whatsoever with the state have got to be ignored. You don't like it. It's a dirty thing. Keep away from it. But on the other hand, there are times when that cannot be done. in the same way as trade unions. There's a very interesting passage, I won't read it, from Marx. He writes a, I think, very funny letter, which is about the movement of the anarchists at the time, abstention from politics. During the First International, many of the anarchists had a slogan called indifference to politics. It was a Russian slogan. And Marx wrote a very funny thing, saying, oh yes, we mustn't join trade unions because we're against the wages system, and therefore it would be terrible to contaminate ourselves with arguing about wages and so on and so forth. I thought he made a very good point in writing that. Now, when it actually comes to it, I think they are at points you've got to answer, not in any particularly argumentative way. I just think if you want to change society, which is what we're involved in, then you've got to actually have a way of doing that, which is going to succeed rather than fail. And that's why I think I did get to the point of attacking the principles of anarchism. But I want to pick you up on one point. When you say that there are, that political parties cannot be democratic and are not democratic, I don't know whether you say they cannot, I simply say to you, look at the Socialist Party of Great Britain. One thing you can say about it, you might say it's completely wrong, its theories are all wrong, certainly hasn't got very far in bringing about a socialist revolution and all the other things. One thing you can say about it is democratic. Every one of its meetings is open to anyone. Anyone's allowed to speak in them. The executive committee meetings which are held are open to the public. The executive committee is elected yearly by every single member of the party. Anyone can stand for it. Anyone can attend it. All the minutes are open. If you want to go and read the minutes of what happened here last Tuesday night, you can go upstairs and you can take as many copies as you like and read them and study them. So it's all open. It's all democratic. Democracy can work within a revolutionary organisation. Sometimes it stops people from wanting to join it and involve themselves in it, because there are a hell of a lot of people who, you know, they want to be leaders. They don't want to be revolutionaries. But when it comes to it, there is a democratic political party. I would argue that we do have a serious way for trying to change society, and that our criticism of anarchism is not simply one which is put there for the sake of argument or for the sake of what is commonly called sectarianism. It's being argued because we believe that we've got a correct series of principles about what society is, how it can be changed, and what it can become. And what we would appeal to people to do is to look at them and to at least give some serious thought to the criticisms of anarchism that you'll find in our journal and, you know, going back in the pamphlets and literature over the years.
Next contributor.
Will the speaker give his observations on the proposition that it must seem as clear to anarchists as to Marxists that if there is to be an overthrow of capitalism, an overthrow of the state, it must effectively be done by what Engels called the vast majority? To go on from that and to take up the point which was made by a question at one juncture, with socialism, who will decide? Not only who will decide things, but how and in what manner will things be decided? Will they in fact be decided by what the anarchists dub the mark of the illiterate?
Very good. All right, on the mark of the illiterate.
Oh yes. I wanted to refer to something, in fact, and I just found it here. On the second point, what I did want to raise, and I think it's a valid point, is in relation to authority in society. One of the arguments which anarchists have traditionally put is that you can run a society without any form of authority at all. Well, in one sense, in the sense of an imposed authority or the notion of authoritarianism, this is absolutely correct. But, of course, I want to read, because I think he puts it better than I can, from a thing which Engels wrote on this notion of the abolition of authority in society in 1870, which he wrote in 1872. And he asked the question, will authority have disappeared in a socialist society, or will it only have changed its form? Well, I'll read this. I'll apologise in advance for the length of it. It's not very long. Let us take, by way of example, a cotton spinning mill. The cotton must pass through at least six successive operations before it is reduced to the state of thread. And these operations take place, for the most part, in different rooms. Furthermore, keeping the machines going requires an engineer to look after the steam engine, mechanics to make the current repairs, and many other labourers whose business it is to transfer the products from one room to another, and so forth. All these workers, men, women and children, are obliged to begin and finish their work at the hours fixed by the authority of the steam, which cares nothing for individual autonomy. The workers must therefore first come to an understanding on the hours of work, and these hours, once they are fixed, must be observed by all, without any exception. Thereafter, particular questions arise in each room and at every moment concerning the mode of production and distribution of materials, etc., which must be settled at once on pain of seeing all production immediately stopped. Whether they are settled by decision of a delegate placed at the head of each branch of labour, or, if possible, by a majority vote, the will of the single individual will always have to subordinate itself, which means that questions are settled in an authoritarian way. The automatic machinery of a big factory is much more despotic than the small capitalists who employ workers ever have been. At least with regard to the hours of work, one may write upon the portals of these factories, "Leave ye that enter in all autonomy behind." Now, what I think he's saying, and it's a very reasonable analysis, is that if you're running an advanced industrial society where you're going to produce wealth and distribute it worldwide, you have got to accept decisions which are going to have to be made on a broad basis, democratically arrived at by the participants in production and distribution and consumption, of course. That has got to be done in a socialist society. And therefore, democracy imposes its own kind of authority, and efficiency imposes its own kind of authority. And the idea that you do away with that and simply have a kind of an autonomy of the individual, I don't agree. But of course, on the point about the anarchist statement the ballot, the cross on a ballot paper being the sign of the illiterate, apart from it being, as far as I'm concerned, a perfectly accurate statement of the way in which capitalist elections take place at the moment, more can be said about it, that it's a very inefficient way, very often, of making decisions. The idea of people going into a polling booth and not having any chance to consult with the people who are proposing things and make decisions in a sign of atomised way, away from everyone else, is, on the whole, it's quite suitable in many ways for capitalism. I don't think it's the most suitable way to make decisions at all in a socialist society. I would think it would be much more technologically advanced ways of people communicating. And what's more, I think that on many issues in a socialist society, people simply wouldn't want to participate in decision-making, even though they'd have the ability and opportunity to do so. They would simply want to leave it to people to make those decisions, not for any particular sinister purpose or apathetic purpose, but simply because in a society it's impossible for every person to be intimately involved in every decision that affects them. Because a good example of that is the Socialist Party itself, which, although organised democratically, doesn't by any means involve every person in every decision which affects a party, because many people are prepared not to involve themselves in them. On your first point about the need to have a majority before socialism be established, of course that's the fundamental rule of Marxist understanding of socialist revolution, that you cannot have change to socialism without socialists. You can't run a socialist society, where, according to the Leninist idea, you have a socialist revolution first and then you tell the working class about it afterwards. It's sort of like having a pregnancy after the birth. And quite clearly, in a socialist society, from the very start, the people who run that society will have created that society, and they will run it because they created it.
Next one.
Can I make a point?
Yes, of course.
I just want to reinforce what Marx said earlier, in case our friend at the back there thought that it was never the position of either Marx or Engels that a majority consciousness was possible. Engels did, in fact, quite specifically say, and I think it was in the same correspondence that Steve quoted earlier, that the establishment of socialism must be the work of a politically conscious majority. and that this would require a process, a long process of education. So not only did they believe that it was possible, but their final view that it was absolutely necessary. But coming on to the anarchists in general, I've always found it particularly frustrating. We used to have a lot of debates with anarchists years ago. There don't seem to be many around now. But I always found that there were sort of two sides to the anarchists. That they used to rave on about oppression and all this sort of thing. And when you actually put the question to them, how is it that workers are exploited? They always had to take up a Marxist position. I mean, you always got that from anarchists. So they went around attacking Marx right, left and centre. But on all the useful things they had to say, and especially when they had to deal with real situations in present society, for example, how are workers exploited, they had to fall back on a Marxian explanation of how workers were actually exploited under capitalism. I always thought. And for example, the anarcho-syndicalists, the most useful things they say come straight out of Marx about working class exploitation and that sort of thing. But just as Steve said, that the anarchists never were able to put the state in its proper historical and class perspective. Even in terms of their own aspirations, this notion of individuality and freedom, they never put that in its right social context either. Because if you think about what it is that constrains the freedom of individuality in present-day society, most importantly, it is your class position. If you have the economic pressure on you to go out and sell your wages, labor time for wages, that is the most immediate factor in your life situation which constrains your freedom. You are forced by your existence as an economic category, a member of the working class, to sell yourself for wages. So these are the economic and historical factors which constrain your freedom. And you cannot consider individuality just as an abstract idea. You have to give all the reasons why individuality is constrained and that sort of thing. And the other, I mean, if you're a very, very wealthy person in class society, then obviously your options on individuality and freedom are much wider, much broader, and they are much broader by virtue of your economic position in society. So it's even when you come down to the notion of individuality and freedom, it's Marxism that makes sense of this whole thing. And ultimately, I've always thought that Marxism is all sorts of things. Politically, it's a class position. But ultimately, it's the credo of the individual, because it places the development of individuality and all the possibilities of individuality and freedom on a practical basis. And these are the sort of differences that we used to have with anarchists. Can I just mention a thing about freedom in relation to socialism and production for use? We've still got to accept, Steve mentioned the tyranny of industrial processes and this sort of thing. Your freedom will be constrained under socialism by a very, very important historical factor, and that is the pressure of necessity. You do not have absolute freedom even under socialism. For example, if your social priorities are that you want every human being to have enough food to eat, and we presume that that's what the social priorities are, that no human being will die of starvation, and then you have a practical task of increasing the food supply. Now, you have no choice about this. There is an immediate pressure of necessity placed on you to organize social production democratically so as to increase the food supply. And that is an absolute pressure of necessity on you that you have to accept even within production. You know, you just can't go off and create, say, beautiful landscapes or something like that. You've got to get the food produced because people are starving. and that is a pressure of necessity that will be placed on you, even in socialism and production to use.
And the next...
Can I just say about this Marxist theory of consciousness? I mean, it's been said here that Marx believed the working class can free themselves from capitalist society. I think that it's very wrong just to say that Marx said that, because on that point, Marx is very competitive. And surely that's the cause of so much debate. So it just leads Lenin to say that come up with the trade union consciousness. It leads George Lukács to come up with the ascribed consciousness. To underlie the whole theory of the party. But Kautsky to come up with a theory of socialism only coming from professional revolutionaries and having to be injected into the working class. And so, I mean, to say that Marx was simply saying that the working class can free themselves is completely wrong, because Marx is very debatable. I think this, what's been done here is you're picking out certain bits of Marx and putting them against what certain bits of the anarchists have said, and knocking one down with the other, without really, if you're going to read Marx or if you're going to read the anarchists, you must try and read them and see what they've said as a whole. You can't, if you start picking out certain bits that suit your line of argument, then that is an authoritarian dictatorial way of reading and knocking down other people's lives.
Well, let me reply to that.
The time is running on and we don't want to detain people. Are there any other contributions?
Could you just...
No, I'm trying.
Don't waste time by giving us an advert of what we're going to talk about.
No, I'm not. I'm just going to say, could we begin to think about winding things up now and take any further contributions and let Steve, unless you're going to insist that he...
Marvellous example of anarchist authoritarianism from the chairman, his instructions to you that you must not make any announcements.
No, that's all right. But now, if you would like to insist
Excuse
that...
Excuse me, you're wasting time here, this man.
No, we're not all that short of time. In fact, we're running quite well.
John's asked a question, he said he could.
Oh, well, in that case, I'll ask Steve to reply to that.
Sure, actually.
Yeah. Well, let me reply anyway. I think it's going to the three points as I understand them, which you've made. I think it's rather unfair to suggest, as you have, that I've selected. Well, in fact, you said that you shouldn't read only parts of what the anarchists wrote and select parts and so on. I think that's not true. I think that the particular quotations I gave from the anarchists are quotations which many anarchists would give. I mean, for example, when I quoted Proudhon saying that justice must govern society, I think that most people who've read Proudhon and agree with what he says would say, yes, that's right, and so it should. I think practically every quotation I gave, as I said earlier to somebody else, if I wanted to look for the things in Proudhon or in Bakunin which were clearly anti-Semitic, which were clearly undemocratic, there'd be plenty of them. I mean, there's so much of it that I could have spent time doing that. I didn't. In the same way, when you say that what I say about Marx and consciousness is untrue, it's selective, I'll put it to you this way. I think there's a certain amount of validity in the criticism you make insofar as that I think Marx held different views at different times in his life, and that I don't happen to believe that you're right in what you say about the Marxist view of consciousness. I think that the Marxist view of consciousness was something which was consistent in Marx's writings. I say that, you know, in all honesty, I've got no axe to grind. I don't get anything out of being a Marxist rather than an anarchist or indifferent. As somebody who's read the views that Marx put down, and I think that even in a time when I think Marx was politically wrong in arguing in favour, as he did, of the possibility of violence as a way of establishing a socialist revolution and insurrection as a way of establishing a revolution, whilst I think Marx was wrong in having held views that certainly could be described in that way, I don't think he ever held those views because he didn't believe in the possibility of working class consciousness. He held those views, as a matter of fact, because he believed, quite rightly at the time, that the working class was, in many cases, a minority class. It was in a position, in many countries, where it lacked also the political access to political power, which in many of those countries it now possesses. So for those reasons, I'll say that. On the point about Marx and consciousness, you know, I'm quite prepared, if you're serious about it, I could provide you with numerous references to Marx where he quite clearly, rightly or wrongly, as you may see it, holds a view that only by its own efforts can the working class establish a new society. For example, Marx was asked to draft the preamble to the rules of the International Working Man's Association, the First International. And the major point he wrote in that was that the emancipation of the working class must be the work of the working class itself. In 1879, Marx sent round and Engels sent round a circular letter to their to members of the German Socialist Workers' Party. And in that letter, I mean, I've got it here, I'm not going to quote from it now, he concludes by making the point, look, Marx, you know, we have always held the view that the only organisation we can support is one which takes a view that the working class must emancipate itself and that this isn't going to be carried out by, I can't remember the exact wording, I think he says something, you know, philanthropists or or intellectuals from above. Very clear. In fact, when you come to look at what Marx said on consciousness, you know, I'd say to you this. If you think that the quotations I've given from the anarchist writers are in some ways out of context or designed to show, to distort what they were saying, then I'd say it's up to you. You know, I know you don't walk around with the collected works of Proudhon, not many people do, but I'd say to you, okay, you know, you can always contact me here. If you write to me at the Socialist Party of Great Britain and say to me, well, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, and here's the evidence, you know, I would be obliged, and I saw other members of the Socialist Party would agree, we'd call a public meeting to retract. I'd then say, what a lousy speaker, what a charlatan who has to rely upon distorting quotations. And in the same way, you can contact me here if you can do it, if you can produce for me the evidence of the fact that Marx didn't hold the view that the working class can consciously emancipate itself, I'd like to see it, you know, it'd be an interesting thing. But I don't believe the evidence is there, and it's notable. You haven't actually cited any. You've said it's there. You've made a reference to Engels' Dialectics of Nature, a reference which, you know, wasn't backed up by what Engels actually said. You made a reference to Marx's Capital. Well, there are a lot of words and pages in Marx's Capital. Again, you haven't told me what was there. So I'd like to know it. But what I would say, in conclusion on this point, is that if there's one thing that we can say as Marxists, is that we don't have to depend upon the writings of Marx in order to argue the fact that the only way you'll get a socialist transformation of society, the only way you'll actually establish socialism, is when the majority of people understand it and want it. We can say that now, here in 1982. We don't need Marx to tell us that. We know that if the Socialist Party of Great Britain, very, you know, a relative handful of the population, went out tomorrow and said, we're going to establish socialism and tell the working class about it afterwards, we wouldn't stand a chance. Why wouldn't we stand a chance? Because the majority of workers support capitalism, passively or actively. That's a hard fact. I don't like it. I'm sure you don't. It's a hard fact. We know very well, in relation to the state is only powerful because the working class is weak. Can't be helped, but that is a fact. We know that if a starving person goes into a shop tomorrow morning and steals a loaf of bread, it'll probably be a worker who will call the police. It'll be a worker in the police force who locks him up. It'll be a workers who carry on. And when the next election comes, it'll be workers who will be electing the government to run capitalism. And it'll be workers who will be rejecting the ideas of socialism when they are put to them. After all, we socialists, we've done it. We've got up and said, look, here's what we stand for. Here's an alternative. And workers haven't voted for it. Now, that is not proof of the fact that the working class cannot become conscious. It's simply proof of the fact that the working class at the moment has not reached a level of consciousness where it recognises that the only object in society worth fighting for is to abolish the working class as a class, to get rid of class society altogether. Now, the way to do that, we would argue, is that you put socialist ideas to people. There's no other way. You relate those ideas to their experiences. You invite people to join a socialist party. You ask people to join with you in taking political action. But at the end of the day, that is what we can do. You can have a strike. You can have a demonstration. You can have an insurrection. At the end of the day, if the majority of the working class support capitalism, you're stuck with it. That's the position we're in. So the position that we're putting, and this is the position that Marx put, is that the working class can become conscious, and that the only way the working class can become conscious is by, first of all, understanding what capitalism is and understanding what socialism could be. And unless those two factors are there, you can't have a serious and revolutionary political change. But capitalism provides...
Are you going out...
No.
...fighting rich suits?
No, you see...
You're not injecting socialism.
But if we could inject socialist ideas in the working class, we'd do it. You know, you'd make it compulsory on the national health. But no, but you see, look at it this way. You see, when you say, do socialists go out and inject or put these socialist ideas to the working class? What are socialists? Socialists, I mean, look, let me give you an example. One day, let's take you for an example. You wouldn't perhaps, I don't know whether you'll call yourself a socialist or not, but you're not a member of the Socialist Party. You're not going out doing this injection operation. But if tomorrow you were, you wouldn't stop being a member of the working class. You know, I mean, otherwise that would be the best way of recruiting people to the Socialist Party if it was a way out of the working class, but it's not. So people join the Socialist Party, they've still got to go out to work. Still got to do all the other things being a member of the working class. So what we are saying, when we say that the emancipation of the working class has to be carried out by the working class itself, is that the Socialist Party is a working class organisation. Members of the Socialist Party go out and say to people, look, you're in this position, we're in this position. No one's saying follow us or let us do the elect us or give us any power. What the Socialist Party is saying is use the Socialist Party in your own class interest. We reckon we've got ideas which are in your interest. I mean, it'd be rather foolish of us if we said, well, look, we know we've got ideas which are more conscious than the ideas which other people hold, but we mustn't say that out of some sort of political modesty. Obviously, we've got to make it quite clear. We think the ideas we hold are correct, and the ideas that most workers hold are not correct. And we say that. And we say to people, if you can show to us why supporting the Labour Party is correct, rather than being a socialist, you tell us.
Could I ask, at the moment, those members of the working class who don't hold socialist consciousness, what sort of consciousness have they got?
They've got capitalist consciousness.
Have they got false consciousness?
Well, if you want to call it that, yes.
Consciousness, on the side consciousness.
Well, some of them have got trade unionist consciousness, some of them haven't even bloody got that. I mean, the fact
that... They haven't got socialism.
No.
And
where
this socialist consciousness is only going to come from you.
Of course it's not. Socialist consciousness comes from capitalism. I mean, look, you don't need a...
I mean, that's through by the fact that we're living in 1982 and
this has. Oh, well, I mean, come on.
I think it relates trade union consciousness with socialist consciousness.
Hmm?
I think it's related to trade union consciousness with socialist consciousness.
Well, it is related to some extent, isn't it?
Hmm.
I mean, how does trade union consciousness arise anyway?
I'm using Lenin's terms, trade union consciousness. And I think you hold that you're not saying so, the same thing.
Why would we hold it and not say so?
Because it's not like to be a Lenin.
In your terms,
you slack Leninist up and say you don't think it's correct to be a Lenin.
Well, grant us a certain amount of honesty. The reason we don't think it's right to be a Leninist is because we disagree with them, not because we agree with them. I mean, if we agreed with them, then we'd think it was right to be a Leninist.
Well, you know, I don't think your theory is consciousness and Lenin's theory is consciousness.
Well, let me explain why they are.
Why you didn't know that Lenin's theory of trade union is consciousness?
Oh, well, I'll do...
Consciousness according to Lukashenko.
Well, I'll do that, if the chairman will allow me. Well, look, it's a simple thing. At the moment, you've got a society where the majority of people are in the working class. Now, capitalism forces members of the working class to do things in their own defence. Very often, In other words, the class struggle, put it this way, takes place regardless of workers' consciousness of its taking place. I mean, I'll give you an example. I know people who are the most out-and-out Tories you'll ever meet. If they find that somebody in the office down the road has got a wage rise and they haven't, they can forget about Toryism. They want a wage increase. I mean, many of these, you know, heroic NHS workers we're seeing about now, who are sort of the latest heroes of the left. Many of the NHS workers, many of these nurses, are people who, you know, they support the most backward political ideas. But at the same time, they're doing, the class struggle goes on regardless of voluntary decision to enter into it. So in other words, workers have to form trade unions. I mean, many of the workers who formed trade unions in Britain in the beginning of the last century, they held all sorts of religious views, all sorts of phony views. Didn't make them bad trade unionists in precisely the same way as it doesn't have to make somebody a bad trade unionist in Poland if he's a Catholic. You can be a trade unionist and hold all sorts of funny views. Now, because of that, trade union consciousness, as Lenin argued, is simply a consciousness of saying, we're arguing about the rate of exploitation. In other words, to be very simple, the workers produce all of the wealth in society, generally speaking, and the machinery that produces that wealth. And because the workers produce the wealth in society, that wealth takes a form of values, and some of those values go back to the working class in the form of wages and salaries, and most of it, or rather another part of it, I should say, goes to the capitalist class in the form of rent, interest and profit. And what the trade union struggle is about, it's a perfectly legitimate struggle, is over how much of the value workers get and how much capitalists get. It's about the rate of exploitation. It doesn't challenge exploitation at all as such. Now, workers enter into that all the time. Now, what Lenin said, and incidentally, I don't regard Lenin as being a sort of an evil person for thinking this. I can understand why he thought it. He held the view that he was in Russia at the beginning of the 20th century, an extraordinarily backward country with a working class of under 3 million out of a population of over 200 million. And Lenin held the view that, look, how are you going to expect these working class, many of them working 12, 14 hours a day in factories, how can you expect them to become socialists? He said, you've got to have a vanguard implanting consciousness into these workers and doing things on their behalf. And that was the whole Bolshevik program. Now, what the Socialist Party says is not that that is somehow a morally incorrect statement, or that necessarily it was historically incorrect. It was possibly quite true that the working class in Russia at the beginning of the last century were very backward and unlikely to reach a high level of socialist consciousness at that time. But what we're saying is more in the order of a fact than a value judgment. We're saying you cannot have a society running in the interest of the whole community unless a majority of members of society decide to do it. You cannot, in other words, impose democracy upon the majority. By definition, a democratic, free, harmonious society has to be the work of those people who are going to benefit from the democracy and the freedom and the harmony. It has to be produced by those people. So what the Socialist Party says, when we were formed in the turn of this century, there are all sorts of other organisations. There was a Social Democratic Federation. They were saying, what you've got to do, yes, you tell workers about socialism, but you can't do that straight away. You have a list of reforms. You get the workers to support these reforms, and then afterwards, when you've got them in the door and in the party for a few months, you say, incidentally, we stand for a moneyless, wageless society and all the rest of it. Then there was the Independent Labour Party, and they said they were going to go into Parliament and enact this reform and that reform. The Fabian Society were going to chip away at capitalism, and as Keir Hardie once said, socialism was going to come like a thief in the night and nobody would notice it. Then there was the various anarcho-syndicalists, and some of those were arguing in favour of what was then called industrial unionism, the idea of having one big union and you have a general strike and you bring down capitalism. Then there were other syndicalists who argued in favour, and particularly in the second decade of this century, in favour of organising, you know, similar political uses for trade unions. All of these people putting their argument. What we said, and we would argue that it was in direct line with what Marx said, is that you can only establish a socialist society when the working class, who are the victims of a capitalist society, decide that they want to get rid of it. Now, that doesn't mean that the working class now has a socialist consciousness. But what is a socialist consciousness? It's simply the ability to do what I've done and what, let's say, give you the benefit of the doubt, you're doing. Maybe you've done it. You've looked at society. You've said, look, I'm being exploited by it. I don't want to. Why should I go out and do a job and make profits for someone else? Why should I have the government? Why should I have all the rest of it? You've come to this conclusion. You want a society without the wages system. You don't faint or have a shock when somebody mentions it to you. You're in favour of a moneyless society where everyone has free access to wealth. You don't think it wouldn't work because of the greedy man or the lazy man or the selfish man. Well, if you can understand all this, then the rest of the working class can.